1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 14 is where we will be starting. And our subject is all things in love. 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 14. Let all that you do be done in love. Paul wrote the letter of 1 Corinthians to a severely fractured church. There were several factions. And also there were some serious departures from the truth. So his letter is an attempt to bring about peace and end the division. And a lot of times he just calls some of them to go back to the basics. You know, realize how this is supposed to be. Realize how far you've strayed from that and return to the way things should be. And so his words on love offer an opportunity to heal these wounds of division. And Paul was so convinced that this was the solution that he ended his letter with this admonition in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 14. So he thought that love had a lot to do with helping them. And I think that there's a lot that's said in the New Testament. I think that we're all aware of that. Said about love in the New Testament. We're all aware of that. Love toward God, love toward fellow man, just so many things. And I think sometimes people focus a lot on one particular thing and leave out all the other things that are said. And it would be difficult to try and cover everything just in one time. But we're going to hit the high points about love tonight. And the first thing I'd like for us to consider is how important love is, or how important is love. In the New Testament, if you were going to sum it all up, if I had to sum up everything in short order, I think what I would do would be to go to Matthew chapter 22. And I would point out here that this is certainly a fundamental teaching of the New Testament about love. It's Matthew chapter 22, verses 36 through 40. And I know that we've probably heard these a lot, but I want us to look at them in a certain way. They came to him with a question, and the question is in verse 36, starting there, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And then comes his answer, where he said to them, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets." A lot of times the point is made that the Jews spent a great deal of time trying to figure out what was the greatest commandment. It said, I remember one source and the number, that they had parsed it down to being 613 commandments in the law and the prophets. I didn't do the counting, so I'll just take that number under advisement. And so out of that number, they wanted to pick out the greatest one. And I think to myself, when you approach it from that angle, then somewhere in here, eventually, you're going to get down to one of them being number 613. And so when you get down to that and the lower numbers, you know, lesser ones down there, there'll be less attention paid to them, wouldn't it? So the thing just doesn't sound like a very good exercise, I don't think, in trying to decide that. And I don't know what difference it would make. But what Jesus had to say sums up everything. And he even says that in verse 40. On these two, that's 613 or even 500, whatever, these two. And I always think of them this way. When he says you shall love the Lord your God in verse 37, and then you'll love your neighbor. Now your neighbor is, of course, your neighbor, but it could be the person who lives in town with you and a lot of other things like that. But the loving your neighbor is loving other people. And so I always think of it that the loving God, well, that's vertically speaking. Loving God. God's that way, with love between us and God, vertically. And the other one, love with the neighbor, that's horizontal. That's among people that we will encounter and deal with. And really, and that does cover everything else. But it also tells us that it's something that, you know, fundamentally is very important. Now, the chapter that everybody likes to refer to when it comes up to love, it's probably always drops into the picture sooner or later, is 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And rather than go down through here and point out every single aspect of what love is, I want us to just look at the first three and notice something that Paul says here that shows the importance of love. In verses 1 through 3, 1 Corinthians 13, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Well, what's he saying here? It's really easy to see, isn't it? If you don't have love, there's nothing. That's what it's all about. And Paul even says, I have nothing. I am nothing. He says in verse 2. He's nothing without this. And as a result of that, he's going to produce nothing of value without it. It's going to be like an indistinguishable noise in, you know, the noisy gong or the clanging cymbal. Every time I see him saying that, I remember my cousin had a cousin, accomplished musician. He was in bands. He could play all numbers, all kinds of guitars and drums, and he was just really good at this. And he was requested a lot of times for different things and so on. And he played in a band that the man was a fiddler. He'd won the state fair fiddling championship a couple of times. Well, anyway, my cousin Kenny ran across this fiddle, and he said it was a good fiddle and valuable and good shape and at a reasonable price. So he contacted the fiddler, Herman, and asked him if he'd be interested in it. Herman said, yeah, sure, you know, at that price. He said, pick it up for me. So Kenny got it for him, and he wasn't going to charge him any extra, just, you know, take whatever the cost was, just get it for him. But he had it in the car for a few days. And so one day we were out on the porch, and he got that thing out, and he said, let's give it a try. And we sat there out there on that porch, and we just sawed on that thing is what we were doing, you know. And it was the most mournful sounds that has ever been heard. It was an indistinguishable sound because we didn't have the right skill. We lacked something. And so the sound ended up being nothing except unpleasant. And Paul's saying here, without love, that's what I am. Just nothing, just a noise, sound. Nothing to it whatsoever. And he says here, he receives nothing of value. It profits me nothing. I think he's saying there that love is important. Of course he is. And I think that we understand that. Now, the thing that always fascinated me is that when you go over here to define terms. Now, our English word love has varied meanings. Some of them, I guess, kind of appropriate. Some, not so much. But everything, it seems like, from I love hamburgers. We have friends that we love. What else could there be? We'll say, well, and of course, God. We love God. That's right. And then there's some activities involved with sex that sometimes is called love. That's really not. It's just more about sex than it is love. But that's the word that's used in English. And so the one word in English has varied meanings. But that's not the way it is in the Greek language, because in the Greek language, in the Koine Greek of the New Testament, there were different words that had different aspects of love. So it was more defined in their language. Now, whereas English is indistinct, the Greek is not. And there were these different types, and not all of them necessarily are in the New Testament, but some of them are. One of them, and the first one we'll look at a couple of them that were in the Koine Greek language, but not used in the Scriptures. But nevertheless, they were available to people in first century times. It's the word eros. And it describes physical, sensual, passionate love, the kind of love which leads to the selfish satisfaction of one's own appetite. It's not in the New Testament. You know, you look at the word, and it ought to look familiar. And if you think, well, that kind of looks like our English word erotic, and that's exactly where the English word erotic comes from this word. And that's, you know, lends itself to activities involved in that sense. Then there is another word, which is the Greek word storge. And this describes a love of kindred, or family if you prefer. Most generally, it's used of parents and children. It is a natural affection. It is a form of this word. It's used three times in the New Testament, twice in Romans, once in 2 Timothy, where it talks about natural affection. And right here, I know that this one for sure is without natural affection. Now, it's not the same word, but it's a form of the word. But that's how it's used, you know, in kindred and family situations otherwise. Now, the last two here, though, have a wide usage in the New Testament. And the first one is phileo. This is used to describe warmth and tender affection, which exists among family, friends, or others. Now, this is a higher form of love than the other two, but it is also a love which is emotion-based, oftentimes, more times than not. And one case is where we have in 2 Peter chapter 1, where what we call the Christian virtues, and you get down to the last one, and it's the word brotherly kindness. And we've all heard this before, that the Greek word is the word Philadelphia. Well, the first part of it is that right there, which means love, and the last part of it is for the brethren. So, brotherly kindness or brotherly love, as some translations will have. It's used in a number of different places. The fourth word that's used for love in the New Testament is the word agapao. This describes a love beyond emotion. Now, it does have some emotional aspects to it, but it goes far beyond that. It's more of a dedication and a devotion. It's a supreme act of will, which goes beyond natural desire. The clearest examples are John chapter 3, verse 16. God so loved the world. In Romans chapter 5 and verse 18, that the love of God is extended to us. And God loves us in all these ways, even though we are unworthy. And I think interestingly, and see, this doesn't come across in English. But it's there. And it's a play on words at the end of John chapter 21. You know the case. It's what Brother Patton always used to call breakfast on the shore of Galilee. And the disciples had gone fishing and they see someone on the shore and it's the Lord. And as things progress in the account, Jesus and the Lord have a conversation. The Lord starts and says, "Do you love me?" That's the English. And he uses that word. Peter's response is, "You know that I love you." He uses that word. You know what's going on here? Jesus is saying, "Do you have a devoted love toward me?" And Peter is saying up here, "I'm extremely fond of you." Not quite the same, is it? So the Lord asks him again. Same word. And Peter's response, same word. And then if you follow along in that, you think to yourself when you look between the lines that with the third exchange, Peter gets a little bit out of sorts with this. Because the Lord asks him again. Looks like in English he's asking the same question, but he's not. Because he says, "Peter, are you this? Very fond of me?" And Peter says, "I'm very fond of you." I've said it three times. But that's not the answer Jesus was looking at. And he has to lower himself from this down to that to get to where Peter's at. Where Peter should be coming from this up to here. And he does it, not at that time. What's it saying? Well, the Lord's really saying to Peter, and again, we don't see this in the English. But what he's doing here, he's saying, you've got a way to go yet. You've got more work to do. To where your answer won't be, I'm extremely fond of you anymore, that I am very devoted to you. That's what it's all about. It's not about the fishing. It's not about everything else everybody comes up with. It's a lesson for Peter to show him where he's at and where he ought to be. And this is really, these things up here, they're fine. They're fine. They're good. Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong on this. But this is the one that we're really hoping for. That's the one in which we should love God, like it says back in Matthew chapter 22. We love Him with all our heart, soul, mind, with everything that we've got. We're extremely devoted to Him. Now, another thing I'd like for us to consider is there are some surprising points about love. I think they're surprising to some people. When we look at them and look at them in any kind of depth. Matthew chapter 5. In Matthew chapter 5, and we'll start with verse 43. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven, for He causes His sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect as your Father is perfect. What's he mean there by perfect? Well, first of all, it means full grown and mature. But in what sense is he talking about it? You see, a lot of people look at that and think, oh, that means sinless. No, that's not what it means. No. Stick with the context. The thing that's important is always stick with the context. If you'll be perfect. If you'll love your enemies. If you can master that. And don't tell me that that's not something that's difficult to do. Of course it is. It's easy to, and what he's saying here, it's easy to love those who love you. You know, that's not a problem. Lots of people do that. But it's a real challenge to love our enemies. I remember back years ago, I started to investigate a man. I'd heard mention of a man's name. Now, he died in 1940, so I never knew him. But a lot of people in our area of Indiana held him in high regard. His name was Daniel Sommer. Preacher lived in Indianapolis, lived there for a number of years, published a paper that was extremely popular among a certain segment of brethren. But he, more than anyone else in the state of Indiana, probably in Kentucky, and I'm sure in some parts of Ohio and Illinois, he did a lot to save churches from falling under the control of missionary societies and accepting and adopting instrumental music. It's just amazing what his influence amounted to. And I had such an appreciation for him that when Daniel, our son, was born, that's where the Daniel comes from. And let me tell you something. If you ask him who he's named after, boy, he'll tell you in a second, I'm named after Daniel Sommer. He knows that. He knows what the man looks like and everything else. And so it's something he's very familiar with. But he had a statement. Someone asked him one time when his opposition to instrumental music and missionary societies, people were just bitter towards him. It's just like if they said his name, they wanted to go outside and spit on the ground or something. It was just this bitterness. But he never seemed to have it himself. And even though he was a man that was described as, I think one time the word always got me was he was described as bellicose. I thought, yeah, he's that. And one of the ladies there in Shoals was actually old enough to remember Brother Sommer, and she said, "Oh yeah, he had meetings here at Shoals, stayed in our house." I couldn't, I was just fascinated by the whole thing. But someone asked him one time about, you know, how other people that were opposed to, in favor of instrumental music, and this going between. He said, "Look at how your enemies are." He said, "No," he said, "I don't view those who oppose me as enemies." He said, "I look at it this way. I have friendly friends, and I have unfriendly friends." And I thought to myself, now that's somebody that's got a grip on it. You know, the right way of doing this. And that's just a pretty good philosophy. It's a challenge to love our enemies. It sounds like he was on the right track of doing that kind of thing. And I think sometimes that maybe that's what we need to do. Maybe just, first of all, eliminate the idea that we've actually got enemies. And that's a step in the right direction. Love also, go to John chapter 13. Love is something that's commanded. Now, here's the thing. John chapter 13, verses 34 and 35. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Love is something that's commanded. Now, right off the bat, that tells us something important. This isn't something that's natural or emotional. That's not what it's talking about. Because those are things that cannot be commanded. Now, those things develop or they arise, even if it's momentarily. But this is something that's commanded. So that tells me that the love he's talking about here, which by the way is agapeo, is a love that must be developed. That's the idea of it. Not something that just you hear something and you have some warm feeling and then everybody, you know, ascribes that feeling as love, or, well, it's a feeling and whether that's it or not, I'm not able to tell and I don't go that way. But I don't go in that direction. Look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verses 9 and 10, here's an example of what we're talking about here. "Now, as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves," now watch, "are taught by God to love one another." Are they taught by God to have an emotion? Are they taught by God to have a natural feeling? No, I don't think so. "For indeed you do practice it toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, to excel still more." It's good what you're doing, but strive to do more of this good that you're doing. So yes, love our enemies. Love is something that's commanded. And there is such a thing as tough love. That used to be a big thing a few years ago. Wonder whatever happened to it. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be as prevalent an idea anymore as it used to be. I'm at a loss at how to explain that. I'm not a sociologist. But I do know that there's such a thing as tough love, and I think it's just something that's described for us in the New Testament. Look at Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 15. "Now, speaking the truth in love, we're to grow up in all aspects unto him who is the head, even Christ." Speaking the truth in love. Not just speaking the truth, but speaking the truth in love. I think a lot of times that the truth gets spoken, but I wonder sometimes if love is behind this or any part of it. Some, I've just seen occasions of this. I've been on the receiving end of it. I certainly hope that, you know, I've never done that myself. And if I have, I seriously apologize for that. But that's not what it's supposed to be, just to speak the truth. It's supposed to be speaking the truth with love. And I think whenever we get into a movement of retaliation and other things like that, well, you know, the whole thing about love is it's just gone. In Galatians chapter 2 and verse 11 is an example. You're just going to look at one passage, but really you could read the whole chapter about tough love. And tough love is Paul rebuking Peter. Now, what's going on here, and it goes into an explanation of it. When Cephas, that would be Peter, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. And he goes on to tell you what he was doing, that he would eat with the Gentiles, didn't see any difference about it, didn't view them as unclean. But then these certain ones came up from Jerusalem, Jewish brethren. And Peter withdrew himself from the Gentiles, wouldn't eat with them anymore, like they were unclean. And others were being led away by this hypocrisy. And even Barnabas was kind of going along with Peter on that. Paul saw this, and that's not right. And so he rebuked Peter about it. I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. That's tough love. It'd be hard to do that. But it's something that nevertheless had to be done on that occasion. And it's a tough call to figure out just exactly when and how to go about that. But we always want to remember that when we do, and when the situation merits it, and we're absolutely sure about this, that we remember now it's for love that we do rebuke someone else. 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 10. At the end of, well, I guess you could say the two letters we know we've got, and now Paul said that, he says in 1 Corinthians, I wrote you in another letter. Well, now he didn't write 2 Corinthians before 1 Corinthians. So there's another letter that Paul wrote. He wrote more than one, wrote more than two. And this one is kind of summing up all the others that have been written. Of course, they wrote him letters as well. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 10, for this reason I'm writing these things while absent, so that when present, I need not use severity in accordance with the authority which the Lord gave me for building up and not for tearing down. So his letters were tough love. You'd have to say, and you look in there, you can see lots of places where tough love was the emphasis. And yet he's not doing this to tear down. It's to build up. He has the authority to do that. The choices are made, how to go about this, and to do it. And you never, in any of the things that Paul addresses, you never see him in attack mode. It's always in teaching mode. That's because it's tough love. And a good lesson in that. Take your songbooks and turn to the song that's been selected. The supreme act of love was in God sending Jesus, and Jesus dying for our sins. Love all the way through that, from the beginning until Calvary's cross. And what we are asked to do is to demonstrate our love in return. And how do we do that? Well, Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Is there one that would do that tonight, becoming a child of God? Is there one that would make correction in their life, get themselves in harmony with God, harmony with God's will? Can we help you to do that? We'd be glad to do so. If you're subject, why don't you come, walk together, we stand and sing.